Wondering how to navigate local, city, state, or the federal government in order to grow your business, secure funding for your nonprofit, or advance your organization's agenda? Welcome to Lobbying Insider, a podcast that brings listeners to the intersection of business and government to provide a rare perspective on how things actually get done. We will dive into some pressing current issues, provide keen observations from the past, and keep an ever-watchful eye on what's coming next. I'm your host, Zach Fink, Director of External Affairs at Davidoff, Hutcher & Citron. Glad to have you with us. And lawmakers and Governor Hochul have just completed work on a new $237 billion state budget. We're going to break down some of the highs and lows in that important document that they do every year. I'm joined by Steve Melito, who heads our Albany practice. Steve, good to have you with us.
Hey, Zach, how are you?
I'm good. We've been in Albany watching this thing very closely. And Bianca Rajpasarad. Hey, Bianca.
Hey, how are you?
Also with Davidoff in our government affairs division. All right, I'm going to read this quote from Governor Hochul shortly after the budget crossed the finish line. It's a little bit long, but bear with me. But I think it's worth listening to in its entirety. In my state of the state, I promised New Yorkers we'd fight to build more housing, improve education, and protect public safety. And that's exactly what our budget is going to do. This budget agreement represents the most significant improvement in housing policy in three generations. It includes transformative investments in healthcare and education that will put our state on the path to fiscal stability. It will end copays for insulin, establish first-in-the-nation paid parental leave, and launch the Empire AI Consortium. This budget cracks down on retail theft and gives us new tools to shut down illicit cannabis storefronts. It helps the children of New York City by extending mayoral accountability for public schools, and we got it all done without raising income taxes by a single cent. Now, I think that is a very good point for the governor, who at the outset said that they're not going to do this by raising money on the wealthy. They're not going to raise taxes on the wealthy. And they did, I wouldn't say hold the line on spending, because it certainly has gone up a tremendous amount. But just in terms of process here, did the governor get, and I'll get both your takes on this, more or less what she wanted in terms of her outline back in January?
Bianca, you want to go first?
I believe, yes. This was an aggressive budget that was set forth. And I think the governor, given the circumstances that were presented to her with the different, obviously, opinions coming from the legislative body, she was able to get together a really progressive budget. Everything, like you mentioned, from housing, the fact that we finally got a housing deal is huge for the state, right? Like this has been years on end trying to get this done. Really being ambitious in terms of like the prenatal leave, including more funding for distressed hospitals, even being able to fight for the New York City mayor to have the 2-year extension of mayoral control over our schools. Like it was, I believe it was a very successful budget for the governor this year.
And in terms of just the process, obviously it wasn't the prettiest, right? It wound up being 3 weeks late. This is something that she has made clear is not necessarily a priority of hers to have on time budgets. But Steve, I know just having been in Albany a long time, sometimes the argument is better to get a good budget than an on time one.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, it's funny. It's the previous governor made it a real thing to have the budget on time. But historically speaking, the budget is very often late. And very often a late budget does have a lot of good things. And to be honest, very often people don't realize, oh, there's no budget yet. No, there's no budget yet. And I think when you're within a certain amount of time, you know, a month, maybe it's not ideal. But, you know, if you're 3 months late, everybody starts to notice. This was 3 weeks. It's a big difference. It's not that bad.
It is a huge difference. And I do think in the moment, especially for those of us who are following the day to day, it does feel interminable, right? Like when is they ever going to come up with an agreement here? But, you know, when you finally put something like that to bed, does the average voter, for example, care that much?
No, I think we notice it because maybe we're sleep deprived along with the administration. But at the end of the day, I don't think anybody's really noticing that. Like I said, it's just not that big of a deal when it's 3 weeks late, as long as you're getting a good budget. And I have to say here, you know, today, I'll give you just going back to Bianca started talking about housing. Today, the governor and the leaders had had a press conference at 32BJ. And so they praised Speaker Hasty, they praised Majority Leader Stuart Cousins, and the head of 32BJ actually called this the house that Hochul built. That's pretty high
praise. That's something we have not heard, yes, right? A lot, right. Right. So, 32BJ being the politically connected union, of course. And they're doing kind of a victory lap on some of these big components that are within the budget. But the housing was so elusive, right? And I guess the two main takeaways I would just lay out there would be Number one, a kind of renewal of this 421A tax break, a form of which has been on the books for 40-some-odd years. They're going to rebrand it, call it 485X. There was no housing being built without it, no affordable housing. The second thing being components of what people call good cause eviction. Now, this was a bill that was taken out of the housing package in 2019 when they radically overhauled the rent laws. But ever since then, housing advocates have been trying to get it put back in some form or another. And the advocates did not get what they want, but they got something.
Yeah, I think it's a starting point, right? And I think that's what you're really hearing from legislators is this is a starting point. They want to come back and possibly put in more incentives to protect tenants in the future. But I think, you know, holding, you know, landlords accountable, putting out regulations and guidelines of what's a small landlord, right, in the state of New York. And now, you know, how are we protecting tenants who, you know, sometimes are under the roof of a bad landlord, right? And that happens in across the state, across the country. So, again, it's a good setting point, but I know, and I, again, hearing from legislators across the state, they're going to want to come back next year and do something a little more. We don't know what that looks like yet, but there is talks of that happening.
Automatic renewals for many tenants can't raise the rent over a certain cap, threshold, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. So, these are pretty significant tenant protections. But, Steve, I mean, if they had the votes for the original, don't you think that would have ended up on the governor's desk? In other words, they had to compromise in order to get something.
I think that had a lot to do with why the budget wasn't on time, is that they did not have the votes. And so you have to work to get the votes. You have to have compromise. They got to compromise, and frankly, you know, the House of the Hochul bill says it all. There is right. A real feeling that this is a very good housing plan. And it's certainly something that nobody was getting, you know, and she struggled with it last year and had to take it off the table, and she has gotten it. The bottom line is on the housing issue, it might not be perfect for everybody, but she just delivered.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it usually a sign in Albany when it's perfect for nobody?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Everybody's a little, in fact, you got something.
If everybody's a little unhappy, it's probably a really good deal.
Because I heard a lot of complaining, not just from advocates, but from landlords as well. Yeah. Right? It's generally a sign that we met somewhere in the middle. We'll see how quickly it leads to more housing stock, but everybody agrees that that is a serious, there's a dearth of available affordable housing in this city and state. Good cause, as it turns out, the elements of good cause will apply to the city. Mm-hmm. Other municipalities from around the state will have to opt in. That was a big point of contention, I think. But different cities have different needs. I mean, you know, to try and legislate for 20 million people is very different. It's a very diverse state.
Extremely difficult. And there's no question that we have a real problem in this city, in New York City, with housing that's affordable for people. I mean, frankly, going back to 32BJ, that was one of the things they talked about. They themselves were concerned about having affordable housing. There are a lot of union members in a lot of different unions across this state and across the city that are struggling with housing. And this goes a long way towards building housing that folks can live in, and we will keep people in this state. It's got a lot to do with retaining people. We don't want to keep losing people to other states.
Right. And they have members who can't even afford to live here.
That's right.
And that's
right.
Where the wage part comes in, right? Right. They were able to get an aggressive wage agreement.
Oh, yeah. Talk about
that.
That's actually really interesting.
Yeah. And I think that was a huge win for labor, for the trades, for the carpenters.
No doubt.
To not only focus on, obviously, building housing for people to live, but also paying people an affordable, you know, rate of salary so they could actually afford to live in New York City. They don't have to move to New Jersey, Connecticut, and then have to, you know, work in New York City. So that was a huge win, definitely for labor.
There were also some really interesting fiscal impacts here. For example, you know, as we mentioned, she did it without raising taxes on the wealthy, despite calls to do so. But there's this whole kind of overhaul of home health care with CDPAP, which was really interesting, kind of surfaced in the final hours there. A major, major change, right, Steve?
So I think the first thing is just for our listeners, what is CDPAP, right? You know, you have home health care workers, which should be self-explanatory because that's what they are. A person who is involved in CDPAP is a relative of somebody who can now be paid to take care of them. And what has happened is that that part of this industry has turned into $8 billion. It really is out of control, and it needed to be reined in. How you reined it in was probably open to quite a bit of interpretation. No question about it. People did not want to see it reined in the way that it was, especially in the business, because what she just did was she went from 700 providers to one fiscal intermediary. So this is going to be a sea change in home health care, and it's unclear how it's going to roll out, but there's no question that she felt very strongly something had to be done, and they took action and they did it. We'll see how it all unfolds, but you can't fault her for actually doing it and getting it done. This has been something that has been around for years. And how do you solve this? And I'm not saying it's guaranteed that it's solved, but she certainly took action and got something done. Again, housing and now home health care. She's made major changes here with this budget. This is significant for her.
And you look at the previous program and you hear what you just said there about how it could be family members or friends who are literally getting paid by the state to take care of loved ones. You can only imagine the level of fraud and abuse that goes on, even if it's by a very small percentage of bad actors. With a program of that size, you are bound to get someone to take advantage of it here and there. To your point, Steve, will this necessarily solve it on one fell swoop? I don't know. I think the jury's still out on that. I don't know that we know the answer to that, but something needed to kind of rein it in.
There's no question that something had to be done. I don't know if it needed to be this drastic. Maybe it did. I think you have to see how this plays out in the next couple of years. But 700 fiscal intermediaries was clearly an enormous, enormous problem that they've, frankly, the reason why you know it's an enormous problem is they have been trying to figure that out for years, and they just made a major change here and went from 700 to 1 in one fell swoop.
Yeah, so we will see how that shakes out. Then you had other laws that kind of creep their way in there that have been advocated for many, many years, always shut out with something like Sammy's Law, right? I mean, you have had people from the city who have been up in Albany, literally camping out in front of the assembly, trying to force the assembly speaker, Carl Hastie, to agree to allow the city of New York to set its own speed limits, because right now the state sets it. By the way, that's a very Albany thing. Albany likes to decide things for municipalities and could govern the city, I guess, arguably, if they wanted to. But on something like this, they finally got a compromise.
I have an opinion on this. You know, obviously what happened to Sammy back in 2013 was devastating, and the city took action to reduce the speed limit.
This was a fatality, a traffic fatality.
Yes.
Yeah. That sort of spawned the movement to overhaul and allow the city to set its own speed limits.
Right, and that's where Vision Zero came into play. And that's when the reduction of the speed limit was brought down to 25, right? Now, with what was enacted in the budget, now we're going to see the speed limit drop down to 10, and some areas 20 miles per hour. And as someone who drives, I'm from Staten Island, right, if you didn't catch the accent. But being a driver and, you know, we're living in what we're calling a green city, where we're trying to move away from green, you know, green emissions and also gas emissions and also getting people out of their cars. Now you're reducing the speed limit, and now people are going to be in the cars for a longer period of time, because it's going to take them longer now to get from point A to point B. You know, I get the incentive, but DOT, New York City DOT recently reported that pedestrian fatalities are down. I think it was like 70%, mm-hmm. right? And that was since the enactment of Vision Zero. So I want to see how this plays out, but I think you're going to get a lot of frustrated residents once they find out that the speed limit is going to decrease. And, you know, people weren't happy with 25 miles per hour initially, but now you're going to drop it down to 10 and 20 miles per hour. You're just going to piss off a lot of people, to say the least.
And you've also seen, I mean, you know, the data show that it is a dramatic decrease in your ability to get up and walk away from an accident, 35 miles an hour versus 25 miles an hour, right? That 10 mile an hour difference does make a difference in a human life. And presumably, if you lower it even further, you have even more of, you know, the person's ability to walk away from an accident. However, do cars strictly adhere to that? Even with the limits, right? And they don't, mm-hmm. is the bottom line. I mean, it's good to hear it's down. I know that a lot of members for many years were publicly telling the advocates for Sammy's Law, we're on the bill, we're for it, and then quietly telling their speaker, in this instance in the assembly, don't put that on the floor, mm-hmm. because, yeah. you know, constituents don't like it. A lot of them drive, take their kids to school.
Mm-hmm. But you also have speed cameras. Yeah. In place, right? That has helped to reduce people speeding in certain areas, school zones, and now they're...
Oh, people love those.
Oh, yeah, we love yeah, those. Yeah, yeah. They're at every corner on Staten Island. Right. But now they're in... what it was a Senator Gennardis bill, I believe, last year. Now speed cameras are on 24/7. So it's like you know, obviously there's things in place.
That was a whole fight too.
A whole fight for that, yeah. But there are initiatives in place to try to reduce fatalities, but it's like, again, I'm being biased. I'm a driver.
You're giving your perspective, which we appreciate. I mean, you know, because I remember the initial argument, of course, was kids going to school, right? So there's certain rush hours of the day in which those speed limits should be reduced. If it's after midnight on a Saturday, I don't know that you can make the same argument.
Right.
I think Bianca just has to obey the traffic.
Yeah.
I try. Okay. I don't get speed.
Sure
tickets.
You do. Sure you do. Yeah.
Wink, wink.
So that was an interesting one. They also had. There's a couple others I want to get into because I think they're worth mentioning. Number one, retail theft. Now, this is a big one, right? I mean, this is something that Carl Hastie, the Assembly Speaker, kind of the height of negotiations, literally said the quiet part out loud to reporters and said, I don't think increasing penalties makes any difference in the crime rate. Obviously, there's a lot of people who differ with him on that. But that was his way of sort of saying, I'm not budging on this thing, that I'm not increasing penalties for retail theft. And that had been Hochul's whole thing is that, listen, you have to increase penalties if you want to crack down on retail theft. Anybody, certainly I can speak only for Manhattan, you go into a CVS, you go into a Duane Reade, toothpaste has been locked up for the last 3 years because people just come in and steal with impunity. And there's been incidents where people have assaulted, you know, retail workers, which is not right, and they have not faced increased penalties. So she got that through despite the objections from members of the Assembly.
You know, she did, and this governor has pretty much pledged right from the beginning that public safety was her number one priority. If you're listening, and I think she takes a lot of criticism unfairly about public safety because she talks about it all the time. And honestly, here you have an example where she flat out walked the walk. And she said, we are making changes here. Now, what I would say is that it isn't necessarily, I don't even think that the speaker didn't get what he wanted here, because the way this played out is that what she did was she got dedicated money to law enforcement to fight a lot of these larcenies that are going on, right? She got, in addition to that, she got a new crime for assaulting a retail worker, which will now be a felony, which I think is actually a very good idea because too much of that is happening right now.
It's like a bus driver or, you know, how they increase penalties for assaulting.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. We are having so many problems with bus drivers.
Right.
It's the smart thing to do.
Right.
And it's amazing how that actually does have a little bit of a deterrent effect. People know about this stuff. They realize now, oh, wow, I can't just shove this person. I could get charged with a felony, which is not great, right? Then she also has tax credits for security and anti-theft expenses because, frankly, I think it's not hard to see when you walk into a CVS that they're spending a fortune on putting up cameras and putting up, you know, they have to put up everything to block everybody from stealing things, which is frustrating. But the thing I like the most about this is that she didn't so much increase the penalties for stealing a pack of gum. What she did was, we have kind of a pattern robbery statute in the state where if you're caught, you can kind of be hit with a string of charges on a series of robberies. We don't have the same thing for larceny. Now we do. So a larceny, if you steal one pack of gum, it's what we call a petit larceny. It's a misdemeanor, okay?
Right.
Now, if you steal one pack of gum every place across the city, you can stack it all up and add all of it together and charge it as a combined crime. I actually think that makes a lot of sense.
Because it'll put people away.
Well, I think the biggest problem that we have is that apparently, and I don't know this specifically, but I'm sure that the police department knows this and the government knows this, and this is why they did this, is that there is a certain percentage of these crimes being committed by the same people.
Over and over again.
The way to stop that is to make it, because what's happening is you go in and you steal a whole bunch of things it seems like you're taking a lot of stuff, but when you add everything up, it's at the most, it's an e-felony, which is almost immediately going to be knocked down. But if you do this over a whole bunch of things and now you've got, you know, $10,000 worth of goods, guess what? You got a serious felony charge on your hands because you've now, in effect, you've now robbed, you know, 10 CVSs. They can now go after you for that larger crime together. I think that's going to be helpful.
Yeah.
I think that's a very smart thing. And again, it's another example of something she, you know, going back to what you said in the beginning, she made very clear that she wanted this. She got it.
Yeah, she got it. And it's also worth noting that the governor is not up for re-election this year, but members of the legislature are.
That's right.
They always say that the governor has more power in the budget process because she can kind of force them to a vote. But in this particular year, happens to be an off year for her and not for them. And I think that helped her with her leverage and her momentum. Cannabis crackdown. You have the proliferation of illegal cannabis shops. The state of New York is trying to get into the cannabis business. They have very few retail outlets. You know, little engine that could. It's moving along. But one of the big issues is you've had all these competitors who are selling illegal product. This will give the ability to padlock some of those illegal stores. And I think that was a big win also.
It was a huge win. And I think that's what the city was. Obviously, that was a huge win for the mayor. That was one of his three asks, right, from the state. I think what you're going to now see, too, and I'm actually hearing from some landlords, are they're trying to figure out if the fines are going to apply to them if they're currently trying to evict the tenant, right? If they're proactively trying to evict a tenant that's selling illegal cannabis, how are they going to get now affected? And that's like the concern going around. And obviously, we're trying to mitigate that and inform our clients. But immediately when this passed, you know, we have a lot of clients who are opening legal shops who are very happy to hear that because these are competitors. But you also have building landlords who are also concerned that they're going to be penalized for something that they don't know about. One or two, if they're in the process of trying to remove them, you know, they could possibly be fined.
Right. I mean, and you had this situation where they legalized the product before they had a regulatory framework that led to the proliferation of the shops. And then you've had a lot of hand-wringing about, you know, how to crack down on them. It sounds like they finally may have the key here.
You know, I don't know if we're, I guess the proof is going to be in the pudding. I mean, this has been a moving target literally with some of these legal cannabis shops, like literally old ice cream trucks that have been retrofitted that move around the city. I mean, it's very tricky to try to figure this out, and you're trying to figure out just how much you can punish somebody for this. Maybe padlocking is going to work, and I think also, you know, they're trying to really encourage and allow local law enforcement to get a lot more involved because, frankly, the Office of Cannabis Management, just like the State Liquor Authority, is never really going to have enough people to be able to go and handle this on a regular basis. The big problem is that there's so much money involved that, you know, you find somebody $50,000, they pay the fine, they open up the next day because their attitude is, you know what, that's one day. Mm-hmm.
Well,
I'm gonna make all that money back.
You could even make an argument that it was more lucrative to go around the state system, you know, and do it illegally.
Yeah.
I'd like to think that the combination of that and now you're seeing more licenses being issued in more legal stores, legitimate stores with licenses opening up is going to gradually level that playing field. And as people start to realize that, you know, here's a legitimate store, which one would you go to? In my estimation, it seems perfect sense that you would go to a legitimate store. It's a lot safer in this day and age, especially in the day and age of fentanyl.
Yeah,
it's just a lot safer to go to a legitimate store than it is to go to a store that is unlicensed.
And they're banking on people making that calculation, you'd think, also.
I hope so.
And you mentioned the Mayor Bianco, which I think is also worth noting here, because I think he came away with a lot of what he wanted in this budget. And I think Hochul was the person who really went to bat for him. They seemed to have a very strategic alliance. Right away, he was looking to crack down on these illegal marijuana shops. He also wanted mayoral control of schools extended, and he got a 2-year extension, which means that he will not be coming up next year in his reelection year to beg the legislators for an extension. That is a very big deal for him.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I think, again, the fact that Governor Hochul was able to get that in the budget so last minute was huge for the mayor, right? Because there were talks within the legislature of doing that as a standalone bill, right? Because there was some opposition from both senators and assembly members, and they didn't want to include this policy initiative in the budget. But, you know, being that they were able to get this in literally at the last minute, the governor was able to
say initially
this.
The Senate was saying, no, there's no way it's going to be in the budget,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah,
I mean, up until like that final week, if I recall, they were saying there's no way. And then the next thing we knew, it was back on the table.
The final couple of days, I think that's really the thing that held it up for 48 hours, you know, somewhere around there. And she got that too. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, that's good too for everybody in Albany because, let's face it, that was going to be one of the major sticking points in the legislative phase as we get into June. That was probably going to be the number one topic. Now it's completed.
It's off the table. And you know that there's an element, particularly in the state Senate, with some in the more progressive wing of the party who feel as though mayoral control isn't working the way that it should, that the community should have more input. And if you let that drag into the second half, it's going to be hearings. The mayor's going to have to come up and explain himself. He's going to have to make a fight for it, and he's probably still not going to get what he wants. This way, the governor, again, having somewhat more authority within the budget framework, was able to kind of jam it in along with all these other components.
It's a huge win for Mayor Eric Adams.
Yeah.
Especially, like you said, the two-year extension. It's hard to understress how important it is to him that he does not have to deal with this now.
Come up hat in hand. Post-election. Right. In his reelection year and beg Albany to do what he wants, right?
The governor did him a solid.
She really did. I would also say overall that leads me to another point just about it did feel like, to a certain extent, the kind of progressive wing within the Democratic Party was driving the ship in a lot of issues the last few years. But I feel like this is the first year where it was kind of taken away. Not only was the good cause not in its original form, it was greatly watered down, and there were changes that everyone could live with, and perhaps even takes that off the table. I mean, I was interested to see even Senator Julia Salazar defending the compromise, even though she was the author of the original legislation. She publicly defended it. But you even had something like, for example, Zoran Mamdani, who's in the Assembly, who has been a champion of these free bus routes, okay, which is something they put in last year's budget, didn't get renewed. That's really interesting, isn't it? Because that is something that not only he was advocating for, Senator Gennaris from Queens, who's the deputy leader, had also been advocating for. So I think, you know, someone was able to say to them, no, you know, we're not doing that this year.
Was it a pilot program?
It was a pilot program that we had been under the impression was going to be renewed. So it does actually last until September.
Okay.
So, but once it runs out, it's done, that's it, you know? And you know, there was certainly a lot of criticism in the sense that you're about to implement congestion pricing and ask people to pay $23 to enter Manhattan below 60th Street, but then it's free for people, you know, on certain bus routes. Like, you know, either the MTA is in crisis or they're not, right?
Mm-hmm. I don't have enough knowledge on why, but what I'll tell you is it didn't get renewed, and I think you may have hit the nail on the head with congestion pricing. It's tough to do that, to start giving out free services and then you have the congestion pricing. So it's
right. Well, especially if the argument
that,
is
that could be. That, it's very interesting, though. Overall,
yeah.
What you were saying is that, you know, again, I can't say it enough. This governor has preached public safety.
Yeah.
And so that's some of the places where you're seeing her try to kind of get back the conversation Democrats need to be having, which is that Democrats do believe in law enforcement, and she stresses that over and over again.
Yeah.
And frankly, I don't think that that's somehow in opposition to progressives. I don't want to speak for any progressives, but I think that they also believe in law enforcement too. And it's just a question of how and what's the best way to handle people. And in this case, I think one thing that was clear is that we had retail theft running completely out of control. And now she's taken real steps to try to combat it. And I think that's really important. And it does kind of, you know, bring us back into a little bit of a sense of where we can actually pass some laws that are useful for public safety.
And Hochul is a centrist Democrat at the end of the day. I mean, I would not necessarily say she's part of that kind of progressive wing of the party, right, Bianca?
Yeah, I think, and that's where she stood for years, right? And I think, you know, she's found the good striking middle ground to work with the progressives, but also stand on her moderate values, which you see clearly in this budget and how she laid it out, and really emphasizing the need to address public safety and affordability.
Couple quick ones and then we'll wrap. I just want to talk about education. She had wanted to change the funding formula. She was not successful in that. I think legislators did push back successfully, and that'll kind of live for another day. I think they're going to study the issue and maybe revisit it. And higher ed, they raised for the first time in many, many years, the amount of money for the tuition assist for individuals who apply for the tuition assistance program, TAP. This is a great way to let people who cannot afford college be given, you know, state loans to go to college. That's a pretty big deal, too.
It's a great thing to see. And one thing I'd also add to that, and just kind of like the same kind of commitment as her back to the basics reading stuff, right, is that it's the same kind of thing. Education is just so important. And learning how to read is so important, right? And reading the right way. And one of the things I guess they found is that we're not necessarily doing the right thing. We've come up with ideas on how to teach reading. She wants to turn that back around. She wants to give people more of an opportunity to go to college and pay for their educations through tuition assistance and all those things. It's all, in my opinion, that's all stuff that's rowing in the right direction.
Yeah.
There's no substitute for education. There's no substitute for learning the right way by the best minds that you can possibly be taught from. And I think that that's all nice. As a dad, that's something I want to see.
That's what everybody wants to see that. I think that's absolutely correct. Okay, we're going to leave it there. Bianca, Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you, Zach.
The Lobbying Insider is a production of Davidoff, Hutcher & Citron, LLP, New York's premier middle market law firm, practicing in over 20 areas, including commercial litigation, economic development, real estate, and, of course, government relations. The Lobbying Insider is produced by Joe Benti, and our sound recording engineer is Devante Addison. Publicity by Jody Fisher PR, with Beth Ann Mayer at Lemon Seed Creative managing social media. Our podcast platform manager is Monica Thomas. I'm Zach Fink, host of the podcast, and if you'd like to help us spread the word about our show, please share it with colleagues and friends, and be sure to subscribe on your platform of choice. It can be found on Apple, Audible, Google, iHeart, Podbean, and Spotify platforms. Thanks for joining us.